Good morning, everyone. I'm Judge Bartley, and I'm joined today by Judge Meredith on my right and Judge Toth on my left. And we're holding oral argument today before the American Legion Symposium of Department Service Officers, a group that's gathered in Leesburg, Virginia. And I just want to thank the American Legion for hosting this oral argument. And we especially want to recognize one of the executive directors of the Legion, Mario Marquez, and also thank Cole Lyle, who is the Legion's director of Veterans Affairs and Rehabilitation. And with that, we will get started. We're here today for the matter of Louis J. Duigo and versus Douglas Collins, Secretary of Veterans Affairs, docket number 24-3046. Would counsel for the parties please state your name and your appearance for the record, beginning with appellant's counsel. Thank you, Mr. DeHakis.
Clifton Prince for the Secretary.
Thank you, Mr. Prince.
And Amanda Radke for the Secretary.
Thank you, Ms. Radke. As you know, each party will have 30 minutes to present argument. Mr. DeHakis, how much time would you like to reserve?
8 minutes, Your Honor.
Okay, we will make that happen, and you may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court. On behalf of Mr. Duigo, I do want to thank this court for the opportunity to present his appeal. This appeal asks the court to interpret 38 CFR 3.155D2 insofar as it pertains to an ancillary benefit. Mr. Duigo received adjudicative decisions in November 2021 that for the first time qualified him with a serious injury necessary to apply for caregiver benefits. He applied for those caregiver benefits in July of 2022, and we ask that by its terms, the court find that an ancillary benefit includes caregiver benefits, and that the board misinterpreted the regulation to exclude all caregiver benefits as an ancillary benefit.
Mr. Hawkins, I've never seen a regulatory challenge fashioned this way. Are you asking us to invalidate 38 CFR 71.40 and 71.25?
We are not, Your Honor. To the extent that the court sees a conflict, then we would certainly argue that it is.
I mean, how? So what relief, short of invalidating that or somehow enjoining the application of the effective date provision, what relief could we give you? I mean, we could remand this case 1,000 times. The board, the regulation is not optional for the board to apply. They're going to apply the same effective date regulation, and we're going to be in the exact same place. So how can we give you any relief short of invalidating or somehow setting aside 38 CFR 71.40?
Well, certainly, Your Honor, if the regulation is dispositive on the point, then it would need to be invalidated. The statute does not require form.
The board could not be clear. I mean, the board basically applied on page 4, 38 CFR 7140, and then it assigned an effective date of, I think, September 2022. So did the board apply the regulation incorrectly?
What the board did, Your Honor, is it overlooked the application of the scope of claim regulation. And what that regulation...
No. I mean, look, whenever there's a regulation or statute or a law that purports to govern something, we deal with that first. Whether there might be another law somewhere in the kind of ambient orbit that might inform that is a totally separate issue. But until we displace the governing regulation, I don't see what relief we can offer. You haven't asked for any relief of the actual effective date regulation that governs the adjudication here.
Well, and the reason for that, Your Honor, is that the scope of claim regulation bridges the gap between the initial claim, the complete claim that was filed in 2010, and the requirement that the joint application be submitted. And so...
Right, but I mean, maybe there might be some duty to assist implications, but in terms of what relief, I mean, the board has adjudicated the caregiver claim. Whether it's an ancillary benefit or not, that would be a moot issue. They've already adjudicated it. They've now assigned an effective date. What relief can we give you as to the effective date? That's what you've challenged.
It is, Your Honor, in the context of whether it is an ancillary benefit. If it is an ancillary benefit, the VA's regulations require them.
Why would 3.400 all of a sudden apply? Why would that automatically displace 71.40? I don't understand that. Seems to be premised on this, and yet there's no discussion of why this would be the case.
3.400 is not the applicable regulation, Your Honor. We don't dispute that the Secretary's caregiver regulations establish that it's the filing or the receipt of a claim. But what the argument is that under this regulation, the scope of the earlier claim necessarily includes any ancillary benefits. And so if a caregiver benefit is an ancillary benefit, the filing of the claim relates back to the earlier pending 2010 claim. And so we don't need to invalidate
Mr. Chagas, I'm just going to read the regulation to you. This is 38 CFR 71.40D1. The date the joint application that resulted in approval and designation of the family caregiver is received by VA. So it's the latest of a number of provisions, right? So it cannot be before the date it's received. You seem to suggest that if all of a sudden it were an ancillary benefit, that this provision here would automatically disappear.
Well, in that case, Your Honor, I mean, certainly this provision, this subsection, would be invalid because it conflicts with.
But you haven't asked for that. Like, there's ways you would go to a federal court when you want vacator or you want to enjoin the application. You ask for specific sort of, you know, mandamus or an injunction. You ask us under 7261 to set aside a rule or regulation. You've just asked us to kind of like you wander around the regulatory code defining things with seemingly no connection to any relief that we could offer you.
Your Honor, again, I don't think that we need to invalidate this because the 3.155D2 connects the joint application, which was filed in July 22, and the claim that was filed, the complete claim as the regulation define or describes it in 2010. So even though this regulation does require the filing.
Say that again. C1, D1 and D2 lay out pretty discrete events that occur. None of those events seem to have any relation to me to 2010. Like, explain to me how this is even possible.
So I'm gonna start with D2, Your Honor. So it says once VA receives a complete claim. So this is any claim, and this court in Chisholm kind of talked more most recently about the use of the Article A versus something else more specific. It's just any claim, a complete claim. VA will adjudicate as part of the claim, referring back to that claim.
You're talking 3.155D2 right now?
Yes, Your Honor.
No. I'm like, put that aside.
Okay.
Put that aside. We're at 38 CFR 71.40. D1 and D2.
Got it.
Those are the regulations that the Secretary literally did notice and comment rulemaking. They published it in the Federal Register. They're obligated to follow this. You could bring a 502 challenge at the Federal Circuit if you want to invalidate it. You could bring a challenge here and seek to invalidate this provision based on the facts of your case. You have not done so. But how would this magically be displaced?
Well, I don't think that it's magically displaced, Your Honor. As I've said, as we argued in our brief, the fact that an ancillary benefit is required to be adjudicated as part of an earlier claim bridges the requirement to file the joint application with that earlier claim.
How?
Because the regulation says so, Your Honor. It says VA will adjudicate as part of that earlier claim entitlement to any ancillary benefit.
But how can they even adjudicate? They need an application. They need to know the identity of the beneficiary here, which is the caregiver. They can't just, you know, discern who this may be and start preemptively adjudicating things.
And we don't, as we emphasize in our reply brief, Your Honor, we're not advocating a position that that first adjudicative decision has to encompass all possible ancillary benefits. If you continue reading, it says the claimant may.
No, you're still on 3.15D2, whatever the it may be relevant for duty to assist purposes if we characterize this as an ancillary benefit. But I don't, unless this deals with the effective date, what you're appealing is an effective date determination.
Yes,
unless
sure.
We can somehow deal with this language, I don't see what relief this court can give you.
Your Honor, the effective date is premised upon the date of the claim that's before the Secretary. And what what 3155D2 does is it establishes claim.
I don't mean to get impatient with you, but the regulation, I'm going to read it to you. This is the governing regulation. It does not say what you're saying it says. It says the effective date of benefits under the Program of Comprehensive Assistance for Family Caregivers, except for a couple of exceptions, which is the latest of the following dates. The date the joint application that resulted in approval and designation is received by VA, the date the eligible veteran begins receiving care, the date the caregiver begins providing. So there's a couple different events, but it's the latest of those. None of this language is anywhere in the same universe of what you're describing of an ancillary benefit adjudicated that was first filed in 2010. And unless you can move this out of the way, I don't see how you can. Until you do, this is the elephant in the room, so you have to deal with this.
And I agree with you, Your Honor. But again, there's a long history of this court, the Federal Circuit, and even the VA in their own rulemaking recognizing that earlier claims can change and do change over time to bring within the fold other benefits that the veteran may not have necessarily anticipated. And looking at his rulemaking on
So let's assume that even if that were the case, why would it not be moot? I mean, okay, so they should have, it's an ancillary benefit, they should have adjudicated it. They have since adjudicated it. It would be moot. He's going to receive the relief.
Your Honor, it's not the mere fact that they should adjudicate an ancillary benefit. What the regulation does is it brings within the scope of that earlier claim. And that scope of claim phraseology has a long history dating, at least back to Clemens, where they talked about what kinds of benefits
right.
are available.
It's a nice hypothetical discussion about, but what relief can we offer you? We're a court. We deal with remedies. The law has to be somehow related to a remedy that we can offer.
So
there's a lot of regulatory code that we could discuss different, how if you look at it this way, it might mean this. What does this have to do with any remedy as to the effective date, which is what you've appealed in this case?
Again, Your Honor, the scope of claim, the scope of the earlier claim must include ancillary benefits. And the regulation anticipates that a veteran may not know or be aware of or even qualify for, in Mr. Duigo's case, these ancillary benefits until something else happens first. And so what the scope of claim regulation permits is that they can wait until that adjudicative decision is done, a new ancillary benefit arises, in the words of the regulation, and then the claimant may but need not assert entitlement at the time the earlier complete claim is filed. And so without invalidating what 7140 does, the scope of claim regulation brings in the ancillary benefit caregiver in within that earlier claim and allows the date of that claim to be to coincide with that earlier claim. And so we don't run afoul of what 71.40 is requiring. It's just the scope of claim regulation has allowed the VA to recognize that, yeah, we took 10 years to adjudicate your claim, Mr. Duigo, and we're not going to penalize you because it took us so long to miss out on all of those benefits.
But the miss out on all those benefits, that's effective date.
Yes, Your Honor.
Yeah.
And the
there's an effective date for this provision. I mean, it is indexed to this exact act. Like, until we deal with that, we're kind of going in circles. But.
Yeah. So I haven't made up my mind yet, unlike some other judges up here. So I just wanted to explore a few things with you. And one of the things I wanted to explore is whether, as pertaining to the effective date rules for any of the other recognized ancillary benefits, like DEA, clothing allowance, et cetera, like, do you have any analogies where VA has generally allowed, like, there's an effect, let's say, I'm speaking hypothetically, because I do have a chart of all the other ancillary benefits, but I'm not clear on how they all work specifically. So are there effective date rules for these other ancillary benefits that are listed? And if so, has VA, like you're saying, like, brought them into the fold of another claim at an earlier date than their application date?
There are, Your Honor. The listed ones, you know, SMC, that's a rating, so it that's the easier one, I think. I think it's the compensation effective date rules are pretty well established. There's also the vehicle adaptation allowance. There's a provision that allows for retroactive payment in the event that the veteran had some work done prior to being authorized for that benefit. DEA benefits, education benefits, and I think that we didn't discuss this extensively in our briefing, but the education benefits are pretty similar to what we see with the caregiver in that the money is for the family member. There's some other element that has to be met. They have to be in college and an approved or in some kind of education, and that's approved by the states and so on. And it can be done retroactively. Now, admittedly, the education benefits have specific in the statutes specific requirements for how and when the family member would apply for those retroactive benefits. But that's not in 1720G, and from the beginning, all that the statute was required was the filing of the joint application. Nothing in the statute ever linked the effective date, to the filing of the application. The statute just wanted the information, and when the original claim, when the regulation was drafted, that was the lay of the land at that time. There was just a statutory requirement that the joint application be filed. So,
gotcha. So, is there an effective date regulation for DEA benefits? Or do you know?
I believe there is, Your Honor. I apologize, I don't have that off the top of my head. It's either statutory or regulatory or both, but there are, but it's typically after the date of the effective date of the permanent and total rating, or, you know, in the event of the death of a service member. And then it's also linked to when the family member is in participating in some education.
So normally how the DEA would work, I guess, is that the veteran would receive a decision awarding P&T, and along with that, the code sheet might say DEA entitlement. But at that point, they don't know who the veteran's children are or what, you know what I mean? Like, they haven't identified a particular child, let's say, or spouse that would be eligible. Is that true?
That can be true, Your Honor. You know, sometimes, obviously, if a veteran has dependent children already recognized, the VA would know who they are. But often we see awards going back decades where the veteran's children are now much older or, you know, and they went to school in the 1990s.
Right. We have a court case on that, yeah. I think. Yes.
Yes, Your Honor. So sometimes the VA may not know who the dependents are, who's eligible for those benefits, which, again, is why within a reasonable time, And this regulation recognizes that it's ancillary to that award, to that adjudicative decision.
The only reason I'm asking is, not the only reason, I'm asking for me, but also just in response to Judge Toth, like one of the responses could be, yes, but DEA has this same similar effective date rule, which might actually be later than the date of the veteran's adjudication of the underlying P&T issue. But yet VA will use 3.155D2 to allow the earlier date for that benefit. Like, that would be a good response to him, and I'm not really certain. Like, if they do that, then why couldn't they do it for the PCAFC benefit as well?
Precisely,
you know,
Your Honor.
But I'm not really sure, like, from your answer, whether that's what the VA does at this point.
Moving on, hop in. So 3.401 is an effective date for ANA, right? That would be an ancillary benefit. 3.404 is DIC for parents. Would that be an ancillary benefit?
DIC could be, Your Honor, yes.
Yeah. So these are the effective dates for those provisions. So the point is that whether something's an ancillary benefit or not, it's still indexed to its own regulatory effective date. It doesn't automatically result of what you're saying, where it kind of merges with the initial claim. It still has its own, each one has its own effective date.
Yes, Your Honor, but again, running that argument out would completely eliminate the language of the regulation, which requires the VA to adjudicate it as part of the earlier claim. There would be no reason to include that in there if the VA was then just required to ignore the earlier claim.
Stop with the word adjudicate. How can you adjudicate something when you don't even know who the beneficiary is?
Well, again, Your Honor, by using this phrase, scope of claim, the VA was invoking this legal idea that the courts have long held, that when we look at an earlier claim, we're looking at what benefits are within that claim, what kinds of things, not only compensation payments, but other ancillary benefits, education, clothing, et cetera, are we going to link up to that claim? When I think of scope of claim, and when I look at how Clemens describes it in particular, and even Murphy from the Federal Circuit in 2020, they talk about what kinds of reasonable expectations did the veteran have when they were adjudicating, when he was filing
right.
these claims.
I mean, the statute, the 1720G, Congress says, listen, you get a joint application, and then that's when the evaluation happens upon the receipt of a joint application. And then the regulation says the effective date is the receipt of the joint application. I don't see how would a regulation overcome that.
Well, again, Your Honor, the statute doesn't have an effective date provision.
Right, but the statute says the application shall be in the form prescribed by the secretary. That's the language of delegation, right? And it's the same in 3513 with the DEA. They say in the form prescribed by the secretary. So the secretary can choose to just allow this to be part of an initial claim and then go to DA, or the secretary can choose a more restricted form of application. That seems to be within the language of delegation.
I don't agree 100% with that statement, Your Honor. I think that the statute didn't specify the effective date of the benefit. The statute was reaffirmed several times. It was amended several times after 3.155 had been on the books for some time. So if Congress wanted that, they would have mentioned it in their rulemaking. I'm sorry, in their
right,
lawmaking.
So the scope of a claim, right? When a claim is basically the government waives sovereign immunity and says you can sue us. Right, and here's how you would file a claim, and so that's what Congress is saying with this caregiver, and then it says basically here's how you file the claim. I mean, it's not a 5105. They could have said nothing, and it would have just been, you know, we would have assumed 5105 would have covered, but they're pretty specific about it under 1720.
Judge Toth, could I jump in with
a couple? Yeah, please.
So I wanted to get to a threshold question that I had. Can you hear me?
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am.
So in the board decision that's on appeal, the board already awarded the veteran a slightly earlier effective date, and you're seeking in July 2022, you're seeking to go back to October 2020. What would flow to the veteran as a result of this earlier effective date that was assigned by the board, or that would happen if he were to get the October 2020 effective date?
So the veterans, and that's a great question, Your Honor, because technically the three provisions that we're talking about here that Judge Toth was emphasizing are the CHAMP VA to the caregiver, and then the monthly stipend to the caregiver. So it's the caregiver's monthly stipend, which is really the primary one, because I believe his wife was already entitled to CHAMP VA due to his permanent total rating.
That would flow from an earlier effective date would go to, in this case, the veteran's wife. Does the veteran have standing by himself to seek an earlier effective date to get benefits for her?
He does, Your Honor, because this is a joint application, and the decision was made based on his claim in the appeal of Louis Duigo. This was not an appeal in Mrs. Duigo's name, and so
the application itself had to be filed necessarily by both of them that started this claim stream.
It did, Your Honor, yes.
And so my question is, if she's the only one that would benefit from the earlier effective date, does she not need to be part of this litigation for there to be standing?
That's honestly something I hadn't thought about, Your Honor, but I think given the procedural history here, she was not the decision was not made to her. It was made to Mr. Duigo, and so that's why he filed the appeal. To the extent that she would need to have an adverse decision, then I would suggest that maybe that claim is still pending before the board, and whether the board, you know, should have addressed the effective date in this decision with Mr. Duigo as the appellant. I don't know the answer to that. I'm not sure that the regulations or any of the processes before the VA has an answer for that either. In our experience, when we do caregiver appeals to the board, the board always does them in the name of the veteran.
So if the benefits would flow, in this case, to the wife, the caregiver, your theory of entitlement on the merits is essentially that we should use an earlier claim stream that was started solely by the veteran. Why would the effective date not tie to the claim filed by the person who's going to benefit from this earlier effective date, the wife, which is the 2022 joint application, which I believe is the first time she saw anything from VA?
So the initial application is for benefits for both the veteran and the caregiver. So the veteran receives the benefit of having a caregiver, and we talked about this in our briefing, particularly at the end of our reply brief, some of the benefits that flow to the veteran by virtue of this program. But the initial application, again, the scope of which is goes back to a 2010 claim. Is for both the caregiver and the veteran, but it is a benefit to the veteran that Congress gave to Mr. Duigo.
The benefit that flows to the veteran, in my understanding, the caregiver program is the services.
It is, Your Honor.
We cannot provide retroactively.
You cannot, Your Honor.
The only monetary benefits that are at issue here would be related to CHAMP VA and the stipend, which flow to the caregiver.
Correct, Your Honor. And again, I think the procedural history of how this was done at the VA. Has kind of forced us into appealing it in the way we have, but what we see, I think, is that the way a way we can look at it is that there's just the claim was filed, it was appealed, there was an incomplete adjudication, there's still or incomplete relief on the claim, and there's still the question of Mr. Duigo's 2010 claim. Did the scope of that claim include the ancillary benefits? Which caregiver as an ancillary benefit. And I think that as the appellant, he should have standing to establish
that. As to that question, You suggested earlier that it is the November 2021 RO decision that may have given rise to the caregiver claim. At that point in time, did VA have any information that this particular veteran needed personal services, needed assistance in his daily life? And you referenced in your briefs a 2018 claim for aid and attendance, but I didn't see that. Is that in the record? Does it exist?
Well, I would point first to in our opening brief, we talked about at record 1549, Mr. Dewego had pointed out the.
So that's from 2022, though.
Well, it is, Your Honor, but we talk about 2010 records noting his difficulty walking and he was at risk for falls and had a history of falls.
But that information was submitted to VA in 2022. I'm asking in 2021.
Well, those were.
When you're saying that the.
Those were VA records, Your Honor, so they were constructively before the VA at the time. And I believe in our procedural history, there was other evidence. I can't point to them right now, but there was a history of falls as early as 2010 in his VA records.
But in 2021, was there a 2018 claim? You mentioned that in your brief, but does that claim exist? Is it in the record? Or was it 2022 when the veteran first applied for aid and attendance?
I don't think so, Your Honor, but I can clarify that and follow up with the court on that specific question. But again, I think that the triggering event, that what triggers this regulation, is the fact that he now qualifies in November of 2021 for caregiver benefits by virtue of having a serious injury, as is defined by the by the regulation.
So at what point in time did VA receive evidence that the veteran had a family member who was willing to be a caregiver? Because as you know, for the comprehensive caregiver program, you need a veteran who's willing to accept the services and a family member who's willing to provide them.
That was July of 2022. Again,
prior to that time, how would it have been reasonably raised to VA that there was a potential caregiver request here if they didn't know there was a caregiver?
But that was not necessary under the regulation, Your Honor. Again, the regulation accounts for the fact that the claimant does not need to ask for these ancillary benefits when the earlier claim is pending. And that makes sense because until November of 2021, he couldn't apply. He did not qualify, period, because he didn't have a serious injury recognized by the VA. And so he had to wait for the serious injury adjudication and recognition by the VA before he could even file his application. So the regulation is part of it is that sometimes the record very clearly shows, for instance, with the automobile adaptive, you have a loss of use of a foot, a hand, whatever, you qualify. You have a permanent total rating, you qualify the ancillary benefit arises. But as with the DEA, benefits, there's still additional requirements. There's still
but
a claimant.
I think in your briefing you acknowledged that for the claim to be reasonably raised, there has to be some indication of entitlement, but it sounds like at that point he may or may not have known that the veteran needed assistance and they probably didn't know that there was a family member.
Well, they knew he needed assistance, Your Honor. As early as 2010 and going beyond that, he has records showing. We pointed to that one in particular because that's right around the same time as when this claim was filed. But the VA was fully aware that he needed assistance, that he was falling down due to these injuries that he suffered in service. But again, I don't read the regulation, and there's really no language in the regulation that requires there to be that prohibits the veteran from waiting for that adjudicative decision and then requesting the ancillary benefit.
Mr. DeHakis, in your brief, you have like three categories, I think, of uh, time periods when the actual adjudication of the ancillary benefit might occur. Like, it might occur, like, right with the underlying adjudication, if we're using 3.155D2. Like, it might occur right with the underlying adjudication, like DEA. You get P&T, so, hey, even if they don't, I believe that in most cases, and we will check this with VA counsel because I'm not sure you had a direct answer to this. I believe that VA, whenever your P&T, just tells you, hey, eligible for DEA. And they haven't checked to see what, you know, whether you have people who are children, you know, of age, or whether you have a spouse or anything. They just tell you that. So that adjudication of the ancillary benefit kind of occurs right with the underlying adjudication.
That's actually correct, Your Honor. In our experience, we typically see that.
But then you raised this, I believe in your brief you had another category of, like, ancillary benefits where they're not sure, VA is not sure at the time that the underlying adjudication occurs, whether the veteran has actual entitlement or not. So I think you were saying, like, has potential entitlement and more development needs to be done, but that would be swept up in 3.155D, that group.
Yes, Your Honor, that's exactly right. And that's actually what DEA and the automobile adaptive claims are. There's still more work to be done. There's still additional information that needs to be gathered in order to qualify for those benefits. And the vehicle adaptive, you're eligible for it, just like he's now eligible in November 2021 for caregiver, but you still have to have spent money or at least received services to adapt your auto, and then the VA pays whoever that was who did the work on your car. In the education realm, there's still a family member that has to be enrolled in an approved school and has to file their own application. So it's triggering the entitlement to it. We hit this in our reply brief pretty extensively, maybe a little too strongly, but we're not asking that the VA must adjudicate every single ancillary benefit. But the regulation permits, by recognizing that the claimant doesn't need to request it at the earlier time, that they can, within a reasonable time afterwards, and we think, you know, 7 or 8 months later, from qualifying with a serious injury is more than reasonable amount of time to request these benefits and still have it fall within the scope of that earlier claim.
And so this language in 3.155D2, once VA receives a complete claim, VA will adjudicate as part of the claim entitlement, entitlement to any ancillary benefits that arise as a result of the adjudication decision. It seems like what you're arguing is those two different adjudications don't need to happen simultaneously.
Absolutely not, Your Honor.
Right. Okay. All right. That's my question.
Okay. I do have one more question,
yes, Your Honor,
for you. When VA was implementing the Mission Act in their regulations, they mentioned that for veterans that do need assistance, this is their language, that the Comprehensive Caregiver Program is just one of many VA programs available to support veterans and his or her caregiver. And then they list out a number of different programs like adult daycare, veteran-directed care, home-based primary care. So even if VA had information in 2021 or thereabouts that the veteran did need assistance, why would it be reasonable that they construe that as a claim for comprehensive caregiver as opposed to one of these many other options that VA offers for someone who needs assistance?
Well, those certainly can also be ancillary benefits, Your Honor. I'm not read up on the specific qualifications for many of those benefits. Mr. Duigo pursued a caregiver claim, and that's the one that he and his caregiver chose because they felt that it fit their situation the best. His wife had been performing these caregiver services without the help of the VA for years. And so when we found out about it, and I would just point out, too, that until the after the Mission Act and the 2020 regulation change, Mr. Duigo didn't even have a serious injury. VA expanded this the definition of that to include any service-connected disability or combination thereof to be 70% or more. So, you know, again, we have a lot of these this information that's changing over time, and if VA had correctly adjudicated his claim when he first filed it or soon after, then when these changes came out, him and his wife would have been potentially made aware of it and could have filed when they became eligible in 2020, as opposed to waiting another year before the serious injury was adjudicated.
So, of course, does the term ancillary benefits show up in Title 38 in the statute?
I am not aware of any reference to those.
So what's the statutory right to have VA adjudicate all ancillary benefits? Where does it come from? Where would you trace it if you had to?
I think I don't know that there's any statutory specifically speaking to that, Your Honor. I think 5101.
Well, I mean, it's interpreting the scope of a claim, right?
Yeah, I think 5101 uses the term a claim for benefits. It doesn't specify, you know, which kind of benefits. Certainly, Chapter 51 is heavy on
right.
the compensation claims.
5105. 5121 does it for surviving benefits, 3513 for the DEA, 1720. There's a delegation from the Congress to the Secretary to determine the form on which a person can apply a claim for benefits. Is that right?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay. Would that be the statutory language that you would trace that the 3.155D is interpreting?
I think it could be, Your Honor. That's a very difficult question to I think that I would point more towards 5101 as just a claim for benefits, and then the scope of claim. The VA, when they implemented that, really leaned heavily on 3.103A and its requirement to review the record sympathetically and grant every benefit that's entitled by the law when assessing what is within the scope of the claim. And I would just end...
Right,
if you have a question, yes, sir.
But obviously VA has some freedom. Like, they used to do informal claims, and then that they got rid of that, and now it has to be formal, and you know nobody's challenged that. That was deemed within VA's authority to do that, right? So they can tinker with the form of how claims are received.
They can, Your Honor, but that goes to a different question because at least in Arellano, I believe it was Arellano, the Supreme Court, you know, basically said we can't pay benefits. The VA cannot pay benefits before a claim is filed. So what 3.155D2 does is tells us what benefits are part of that claim that Mr. Duigo filed in 2010. It has to include ancillary benefits, and so if caregiver is an ancillary benefit, then it's within the scope of that claim. And so we don't run up against a statutory prohibition of paying benefits if it's within the scope of that 2010 claim.
Yeah, I mean, I know we've covered a lot of ground, but on rebuttal, I do want you to address, if everything you said is correct there, what still would the remedy be here? Because there's an effect, the effective date is the elephant in the room. I feel like we're not addressing that.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Dehakis. Mr. Prince?
Good morning. May it please the court. This case is not about ancillary benefits for three main reasons. First, the plain language of Section 3.155 notes that it's applicable to Part 3. The PCAFC is in Part 71. Next, the plain language of Section 3.155D2 notes that entitlements must be adjudicated as part of the adjudication decision. However, statute provides that the PCAFC is not an entitlement. Last, eligibility for the PCAFC requires a joint application. Again, as Judge Toth seemed to direct his line of questioning, this case is about effective date. The earliest possible effective date for the veteran and his family caregiver's award of eligibility for PCAFC was July 12, 2022, the date of their statutorily mandated joint application. The specific regulation, 71.40D1, provides that the effective date under the PCAFC controls and not the general regulation 3.155D2 discussing ancillary benefits.
I want to ask you about the second thing you mentioned, that it's not an entitlement.
Yes,
what is it then?
It's a comprehensive health care program. First, statute provides, and that's at 1720G C2B, Congress specifically noted that it's not an entitlement. The statute provides that. 3.155D2 discusses entitlements that arise as a result of the adjudication decision.
It's certainly a benefit, though. I mean, receiving a stipend and training and support for providing caregiver, it's certainly a benefit.
Well, Your Honor, it's more of a health care program. It's not similar to the Part 3 benefits that are discussed in 3.155D2, like DA benefits, SMC. It's a health care program. Essentially, VA is teaching a family caregiver how to perform services for the veteran in home.
Well, Mr. Prince, are you referring to this, the language that begins 3.155, the provisions of this section are applicable to all claims governed by Part 3? Is that what you're referring
to? Correct, Your Honor.
Yeah, but isn't that talking about the underlying claim? It's not talking about the auxiliary necessarily. I mean, we have plenty of auxiliary benefits that are in Part 17 or in other parts, like clothing allowance and auto adaptive.
Auto adaptive is at 3.808, Your Honor.
Yeah, but it's. Let me refer to my little list here. It is. VHA must approve the need for adaptive equipment. VHA determines eligibility for clothing allowance. We don't really have, CHAMP VA is obviously a VHA type thing. So it just seems like there's several auxiliary benefits that don't fall into the category. But I mean, that you're saying that they should fall into, which is like being mentioned in Part 3. But, I mean, nevertheless, this language that begins 3.155, I don't know how you could read it other than that it's talking about the underlying formal claim that's been filed and not the auxiliary benefits or claims or whatever, however you want to characterize them, that are mentioned under D. Just talk to me about that, because maybe I'm wrong.
Well, Your Honor, we would argue that the rules of canons of regulatory interpretation would mean that the plain language of the regulation is controlling. So with regard to even the examples that are provided in Section D2, those are all Part 3 benefits, and inclusive of automobile allowance. The eligibility determinations, and I think the court was asking opposing counsel about this earlier, the eligibility determination with regard to DEA benefits, SMC benefits, those are adjudicated just based solely on the underlying service-connected condition or the rating. With regard to the entitlement to those benefits, those are adjudicated by VHA. So VBA makes a underlying adjudication regarding service connection rating. They ultimately can then in turn award, say, dependents' educational eligibility. They don't make an entitlement determination until other factors are included.
But if the underlying requirement for caregiver, I'm going to call it a benefit even though you're not, for the caregiver program, let's say, or benefit, is a 70% and a severe disability, whenever a 70% is awarded, couldn't, just like VA does with these other ancillary benefits, couldn't VA let the veteran know that they're now eligible for caregiver, and that process is started. Send a form. I believe that's what they do for DEA. Yeah. So it wouldn't necessarily be any different. So then the process of application is started.
No, Your Honor. The requirements aren't solely serious injury 70%. There are various eligibility requirements laid out in 71.25 that include the best interests of the veteran.
Yes, but that's true for the other auxiliary benefits as well, like DEA. You have to be a child or a spouse. Like you can't. There are some other eligibility requirements, but when VA determines that a veteran is eligible or the family members are eligible for DEA, there are still other determinations that need to be made. But whenever he's determined to be P&T or meets one of the other requirements for one of the other eligibility factors for DEA, then VA just says on the code sheet, you know, DEA eligible. I have their language here, but it's something like that. It's just literally one sentence.
Your Honor, I'd again draw a distinction between eligibility and entitlement. So with regard to eligibility, the only factors with regard to DEA is permanent and total disability. There's no question of eligibility beyond that. Entitlement is dependent on whether you have dependents, whether they're a certain age, so on and so forth. Same with automobile allowance. The eligibility is determined based solely on the service-connected disabilities and the rating and, you know, whether blindness, ankylosis of certain joints, so on and so forth. With regard to the PCAFC, you can't reach eligibility without a number of factors that are all listed in 71.25, which include having a eligible family caregiver. There's no immediate determination of eligibility just based solely on the service-connected disabilities or the rating that you may have. So while you wouldn't establish or you can't establish eligibility without a 70% rating or serious injury or illness, there's still various other eligibility criteria that you must meet to even establish eligibility. So VBA can't adjudicate that at any point without VHA input. With regard to the examples listed in 3.155D2, there are those adjudications can occur without any input from or medical assessments from VHA.
Uh-huh. And in your brief, you just the fact that you're making this pretty weighty distinction between VHA and VBA, I think. You cited Massey in your brief to support that distinction?
Your Honor. We didn't cite any distinction between VHA and VBA benefits. The board did, and we...
Oh, well, then it was the board.
We would concede that the board's statement of reasons and basis contains harmless error, but the distinction between VBA and VHA, as the board put it, the benefits being distinct, we wouldn't take that position at this point. However, there is a distinction between the eligibility determination required for the PCAFC and the eligibility determination required for the examples listed in 3.155D2.
Uh-huh. And so a veteran arriving at 100, being adjudicated as 70% disabled,
yes.
Which to me seems like a baseline requirement on the part of the veteran who's having an adjudication, that you are not convinced that that means anything here.
Your Honor, the regulation provides that there are eligibility criteria for the veteran and for the family caregiver. And those eligibility criteria are more than just 70% disability. So, it's not a matter of me disagreeing with that. It doesn't mean anything. I think that it means something. It's one of the steps or one of the criteria that are necessary to establish eligibility for PCAFC, inclusive of a number of other criteria that wouldn't be reasonably raised by a claim of entitlement to service connection or a grant of service connection or even, say, a grant of total disability. Merely because a veteran is totally disabled does not render him or her eligible for the PCAFC because, again, it's a healthcare program as opposed to a compensation sort of claim.
Okay. Well, relatedly, the DEA decision does – my understanding is that whenever a veteran, among other things, whenever a veteran is rated permanent and total, then that decision will actually have at the bottom entitled to DEA benefits, even though at that point the VA has not investigated whether there is an eligible spouse or whether there are eligible children. Is that the case?
No, Your Honor. The code sheet says eligibility for DEA benefits. The entitlement is a separate adjudication. However, it's actually not an adjudication. It's a separate question that must be answered, and that's whether you have dependents, whether your dependents are of a certain age, whether they're enrolled in certain programs. But 38 U.S.C. Section 3510 provides for, and this concerns DEA benefits, that each eligible person, ellipses, shall be entitled to receive educational assistance. With regard to the PCFC, 1720GC2B specifically says that this does not create an entitlement. So I would draw a distinction between, or the Secretary would draw a distinction between eligibility and entitlement. Eligibility is established solely based on, for again, those benefits that are available through 3.155D2. Again, first they're in part three. But beyond that, they're eligible, and the entitlement is immediate, and it can be awarded by just meeting, you know, certain thresholds for service-connected disabilities and rating.
Uh-huh. So what definition, I understand what you're saying, what definition are you using for ancillary? What is VA's definition?
Well, Your Honor, it would start from benefits or benefits that are in Part 3, then benefits that can be awarded through the adjudication decision, and those are generally reasonably raised by the adjudication decision, but also entitlement, because that's specifically noted in 3.155D2. So first, you'd have to have a Part 3 benefit. You'd have to have entitlement established through a reasonably raised claim based on the adjudication decision. Here we have a service connection adjudication decision, which can't possibly raise whether the veteran has a family caregiver, let alone is requiring in-home care, whether he meets or she meets the other remaining eligibility criteria.
And so CHAMP-VA is not a CHAMP-VA, I believe, doesn't meet those requirements. Part three, it's not.
I'm not familiar with CHAMP-VA as a whole, so I can't specifically state. But my understanding is, with regard to the PCAFC, the caregiver being eligible for CHAMP-VA is one thing. But however, 3.155D2 does not discuss CHAMP-VA, and I'm not sure whether that's a solely eligibility determination or whether it's an entitlement that ultimately comes from meeting some other criteria. I'm not familiar with how that benefit is awarded specifically.
Okay. So you mentioned a few things there. Let me just say, I think you're wrong about the Part 3 part of this, because it doesn't make any sense in terms of what are normally considered CHAMP-VA benefits. But at any rate, one of the things you mentioned, and I think probably maybe the more significant one, is whether it could be reasonably raised by a underlying adjudication. Didn't you say those words you used?
Yes, Your Honor, and those words are, well, not reasonably raised, but arise as a result of, or
right.
Regulations language.
So putting aside it occurs to me that what really matters is what ancillary means here, and the phrases that are used throughout the final rule for 3.155, whenever it became finalized in 2014, is the language that was used was benefits logically related to the underlying claim, reasonably within the scope of an underlying claim, arise in connection with a pending claim, or, as you said, the actual language of the reg itself, arise as a result of the adjudication decision. So that's, is that your framework for what would, what ancillary is? That's like the...
Yes, Your Honor. But also, again, the Secretary's position is that this is not a question of whether the PCFC is ancillary to a service connection claim, because, again, the service connection claim, if the service connection claim doesn't raise the eligibility criteria, or an award of service connection doesn't raise the eligibility criteria, there are a number of criteria that are required that are in part clinical determinations, but not raised by any adjudication decision with regard to service connection, increased rating, or so on.
Well,
so
but
far.
The basic, I mean, one of the many requirements for PCFC is that the veteran have a 70% severe disability.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes. However, that and we argue this in our brief, that if a service connection claim in and of itself raises entitlement to every potentially ancillary benefit, then ultimately VA would be required to adjudicate every potential benefit based on a service connection claim. And again, the eligibility determination is, it would not be pro-veteran for the Secretary to adjudicate claims and deny them because the veteran can't meet the eligibility criteria without, well, a number of things, but okay. Just as an ancillary benefit. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Well, I just have VA Form 21-8760 here,
okay.
And it is called Additional Information for Veterans with Service-Connected Permanent and Total Disability. And basically what they do whenever they award P&T is they include this list, which is basically just, it says benefits for veterans, specially adapted housing. It explains specially adapted housing. Special home adaptation grant, it explains that. Auto adaptive equipment benefits, it explains that. Dental treatment, it actually has something for Social Security. DEA is included, so is CHAMP VA, and one or two other things. So, like, what would be the problem with putting PCAFC on here? It's not a guarantee that you're going to get this benefit or that you have met the myriad, I admit there are myriad requirements for entitlement to PCAFC, but it certainly wouldn't break VA's, you know, back to add this to the list, right?
I would disagree, Your Honor.
Okay.
But with regard, outside of CHAMP VA, which, again, I'm not well-versed in, first, I would say that all those benefits that are listed are in Part 3. So, our position is that 3.155D2 and 3.155 as a whole applies to Part 3 benefits. But beyond that, the eligibility criteria is for those benefits are based solely on, again, the service-connected disability that the veteran may have and the rating. And so, if you're a totally disabled permanent and totally disabled veteran, you're eligible immediately for each one of those benefits that are listed.
Sorry to interrupt, when does this eligibility determination happen? Because, I mean, it sounds like, so there are certain markers that would suggest you're potentially entitled to this, right? But it doesn't sound like there's any preemptive eligibility rating. They're not sending out applications, are they, to people that they would deem potentially entitled?
The triggering event, Your Honor, for this would first be the joint application.
Right, but then they can just go right to entitlement. I mean, there's no, right, you would, it's just basically these are elements, things you got to satisfy, it's all entitlement. I don't see with this eligibility entitlement distinction, I understand it conceptually, but it doesn't really make any sense unless there's like something happening before, you know, sending out applications or making some kind of prima facie determination.
So again, Your Honor, the PCFC is a healthcare program. It's not the same as a compensation benefit. So, whichever There's no statutory requirement for notice of each program.
Well, there's a statutory requirement for outreach. I mean, that's in the statute. And, I mean, it seems like a lot of this could be solved by just if you see something in the adjudication that suggests a person might need care, send an application, right? Whether there's a caregiver, nearby that's stated or not. I mean, certainly could send an application, right? That wouldn't be operationally onerous, right?
That's a result of considering one of the criteria for eligibility for the PCAFC is whether it's in the best interest of the veteran, and that's a clinical determination. Generally, healthcare providers, the veteran's healthcare provider, they see the circumstances surrounding this, and they inform the veteran of the program.
So, that would be entitlement, right? But you're suggesting, what you're saying is this eligibility is a lot more difficult to make in reality than just, I mean, what if it were pretty simple, anybody who seems like they need care? Okay, let's send an application to. Whether they're entitled or not is will be determined later.
Well, again, Your Honor, first, a joint application is required by statute. Beyond that, whether a veteran needs care could be a triggering event, and as I believe Judge Meredith was reading off the Federal Register, there are a number of programs that are available that aren't necessarily the PCAFC, which is what we're dealing with here. So for the PCAFC, again, the triggering event is specifically filing a joint application. However, notification or informing the veteran of the program is generally provided by, there's information on the VA website, there's information that there are outreach programs that are, as you said, statutorily required. But in terms of just information, it's usually just provided by the veteran's healthcare provider. It's VA healthcare provider. It's not if you're service connected, then ultimately we send you an application. Or if you are married and are at 70%, then VA sends you an application. There again, the criteria for establishing eligibility are many, and therefore there are multiple determinations, mostly medical determinations, of whether this veteran is eligible and will ultimately receive welcomed into the program or part of the program.
Counsel, could I ask you what I was talking with about your counterpart? He acknowledged that an earlier effective date here, what would flow potentially from that is CHAMP VA for the caregiver, the wife in this case, and potentially the monthly stipend. So do we need the presence of the caregiver in order for them to be standing here in the litigation?
No, Your Honor, because the caregiver wouldn't be eligible for the program without the veteran, and the caregiver is receiving training, assessments, the benefits through the veteran. So our position at this point is that the veteran has standing, and the veteran would have standing without the caregiver.
What relief would flow to the veteran as a result of a favorable determination?
Your Honor, no relief, because, again, this is a healthcare program. This is not a...
But isn't that necessary for standing, that there's some relief that we could provide?
Yes, Your Honor.
To him, because he's the only litigant we have in front of us.
Yes, Your Honor. I would need to think more about the standing question. However, I would agree that there's no benefit that would flow from assigning an earlier effective date. That's because, again, the program is a healthcare program. You can't provide retrospective healthcare. We don't believe that any benefit would flow. However, the effective date that's assigned is mandated by the regulation, and that regulation states that the joint application is for our purposes in this appeal, that the effective date would be the date of the joint application.
And prior to that, in July 2022, receiving the application jointly from the veteran and his caregiver, did VA have any information? Had they received evidence that the veteran did have a family caregiver?
No, Your Honor, and that's solely because, again, the eligibility criteria for a family you can't become a family caregiver until you're deemed a family caregiver. So whether there is a person that cares for the veteran, that would be more akin to SMC aid in attendance as opposed to participation in the PCAFC. For the PCAFC, it requires training through VA, in-home assessments, wellness checks. Those things can't be completed to even establish a family caregiver until after a joint application is filed. So,
I meant it in a more generic sense. Did they know there was a family member caring for them?
We would say perhaps, but that's also what resulted in the award of aid in attendance. So,
subsequently, it was after the award of caregiver benefits.
Your Honor, it's kind of, the determination of whether there's someone that lived with the veteran that was providing some service, I'm not sure. But with regard to whether the person was a caregiver under VA's definition of caregiver, that did not occur until the joint application was filed and then assessments were made and the eligibility determination was rendered.
Do you know the answer to what I asked your counterpart? Was there a 2018 application for aid in attendance?
I'm not aware of that, Your Honor. I would say, again, aid in attendance would be a separate benefit than an eligibility for the PCAFC. So, again, this case is about effective date. Oops, sorry. This case is about effective date and not whether the PCAFC is an ancillary benefit. The effective date is tied to statute and regulation, and that effective date must be the date of the joint application. And for those reasons, we would urge the court to affirm the board's decision.
Thank you, Mr. Prince. Mr. Dukakis, you may move with rebuttal.
So, Judge Toth, I do have a remedy, but I'd like to save that for the end just to get through some of these points. And I'll start where the Secretary ended in that this is not about an effective date. This is about the scope of the 2010 claim. If the regulation applies, if caregiver benefits are ancillary, then they are within the scope of that claim, notwithstanding the requirement in the statute of filing a joint application. All that the statute requires is the information to identify the caregiver, identify the veteran, so that the program can adjudicate their claim and determine whether they
qualify.
What's
the board going to do when we remand it? You're challenging the effective date. What effective date are they going to assign? What regulation are they going to use to assign that effective date?
So the regulation, Your Honor, is the 3.155 will tell them that the claim was filed in 2010. Now, admittedly...
Okay, I mean, we're back.
Right, Your Honor. I mean, I think we just...
So 7140, you're not asking them to validate it. You're
asking
the board to basically ignore it.
Not ignore it, Your Honor.
Just pretend let's just pretend it's not there. Is that the remand instructions to the board? Like, pretend this... Why didn't you just ask for an injunction? I mean, this is what you're asking for. And, instead of hiding the ball, like, why not just ask for it?
Well, to the extent the court will allow us to and that they think that the court finds that necessary to offer the relief we're seeking, obviously we would gladly accept that as relief.
You've appealed an effective date. You're asking for a remand. The board is bound by the regulations the secretary promulgates. That's the regulation that governs effective dates. However they were to define ancillary benefits has no effect on that.
Well, it does, Your Honor, because in 2010, informal claims were permitted. And this regulation codifies that idea of expanding the scope of a claim to include other things that aren't strictly on the form. Judge Bartley was talking about some of the language in the rule making, and I would just emphasize some of those logically placed at issue. Reasonably raised, but...
Let me ask you this, then. there's a, like, aid in attendance, right, is an ancillary benefit. I mean, you seem to operate under this premise that ancillary benefits automatically merge into the initial claim, as if they're like a TDIU, that they're part of the, that seems to be the premise of this.
Not in all cases, Your Honor. They certainly can automatically merge, but sometimes the regulation recognizes that sometimes the veteran has to wait until a later date to request those ancillary benefits.
Right, but they have their own discrete effective date regulations, each one of them. Why would the caregivers program not also have its own discrete regulation?
Well, they do, Your Honor, when they're filed as a standalone, this is all I'm looking for, brand new claim. So there's nothing pending, and the veteran says, now I need aid and attendance. I'm going to request aid and attendance.
Why would you even need, you would not need the 7140 to tell you that.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
You would not need 7140 to tell you that when you file a claim with nothing.
Right. Previous. Correct,
so
Your Honor.
You wouldn't need it.
No. I mean, we do because that tells us how to treat that joint application. But when there is a prior claim pending and the scope of that claim includes something else, then that becomes the date of claim for purposes of establishing the effective date. And the fact that the statute only requires the joint application.
Right, but, again, under 502, if you were arguing this in the D.C. Circuit, you would challenge the validity of the effective date here because it's in fundamental conflict with another regulatory provision that you believe governs. That's the nature of the claim that you've brought here. But your reply brief just mentions none of that. And that's it. There's an entire line of analysis that we would have to conduct to do that. And you don't even cite the regulation.
No, Your Honor. And I, again, I don't think the court needs to invalidate the regulation in order to offer Mr. Duigo relief because the claim, by virtue of 3155D2, is January 2010. And so that's our position. And I understand exactly what you're telling me,
Your Honor.
Unless
we invalidate it, every single time we send it back to the board, they're going to apply this regulation. I mean, we're going in circles. So.
Yes, Your Honor. So, but this is about scope of claim. And on standing, Judge Meredith, I would just ask the court on motion that Mrs. Duigo, as a caregiver, be allowed to intervene in this case so that if the court deems that she is necessary for standing, then we can do that. We have a contract with her, and I'd like to file a motion here. And we can follow up, of course, with a written request with more information. But she would ask to intervene so that the standing issue is not an obstacle.
And let me just clarify: you're going to file a motion.
I will, Your Honor. Yes, we will file a written motion. And so the secretary is really I'm running out of time, but I have a couple points I want to really highlight. The Part 3 idea that only Part 3 benefits. As Judge Bartley explained, CHAMP VA is not a Part 3 benefit. The language of the regulation is talking about the reference to all claims governed by Part 3 is the complete claim in the very first sentence of D2. So it's that claim, a claim filed under Part 3, that's what this regulation describes the scope of. So it pulls in all these non-Part 3, other Part 3 benefits as part of the scope of that claim. It doesn't limit ancillary benefits in any way because the Secretary, I wasn't entirely sure, but they seem to agree that at least CHAMP VA benefits are, and certainly DEA benefits are not within Part 3. And the regulation, we just reemphasize again, the regulation is not directing VA to adjudicate anything. It's simply describing and telling us and informing us what is the scope of that claim. It includes all of these ancillary benefits. And the idea that there's an eligibility versus entitlement is really a red herring because eligibility is only possible for many of these, the DEA, the auto, and caregiver, once a certain service-connected disability rating has been authorized, and so that's again we point back to the idea that the secretary himself recognizes that they can request these benefits at a later time and not with the complete claim. So for relief, we would ask that the court find that because a 70% disability, service-connected disability, is the first eligibility requirement for a caregiver, it arises as a result of at least the first rating decision that makes that adjudication. And because it is an ancillary benefit, it is within the scope of the 2010 claim. This means that the joint application relates back to the 2010 claim.
Sorry, I mean, I've obviously beat you up on the effective date, but putting that aside, if this is an ancillary benefit, right, and it arises, so we've gone through this entitlement, eligibility entitlement thing. So an adjudicator notices something that suggests a veteran might need care. Would they send an application to the person? Is that what you're asking?
Yes, I think that's a reasonable interpretation of the outreach statute.
Yeah, how long do they have to wait for it to come back? I mean, do they have to just hold the adjudication? What if it takes a year to?
They can certainly put a reasonable time limit on it, Your Honor. I mean, I think that the Secretary is very good at putting the veteran on the clock.
Are there other, like in DEA, do they send an application? It's just like you might be entitled to these benefits.
The DEA, they don't do anything, Your Honor.
Right, right.
They mention on page 10 of 50 that DEA is available, but the family members are never told that they qualify. They're relying on the veteran to pass that information.
So they give a kind of blanket information to the veteran.
Yes, Your Honor.
Why would that? Because they can't adjudicate without a claimant. The claimant here is the caregiver. Like, what
right.
can they actually adjudicate? Because the word adjudicate is significant. They can send stuff. They can make them aware. They can put a process in motion. But they can't adjudicate this.
Well, the regulation is not requiring that, Your Honor. There's no rule that says every single benefit, every single entitlement has to be done at the exact same time. The VA often piecemeals adjudications. And this regulation recognizes that. And so it's simply recognizing that once a 70% disability rating is first assigned, the veteran now qualifies for caregiver. And within a reasonable time, as we said in our briefing, if they come back and say, you know what, I want this caregiver benefit, the regulation is saying they're going to adjudicate it as part of the earlier claim, not concurrent with
TDA, obviously they refer it, they kind of spin it off. Like, would they have to halt the adjudication? Would they have to come up with new regs to see how long they wait for the application? This sort of raises some other questions.
Potentially, Your Honor, but I think that, again, that they're recognizing that it's within the scope of that claim, and so that's the effective date. That's the date of claim when we're looking at establishing an effective date.
You went back to effective
date. I know, Your Honor.
I'm going to have to cut it off here. Since we ran over a little bit on rebuttal. The court thanks the parties very much for their arguments, and again, we thank the American Legion for hosting this event, and it's nice to see all of you out here watching the argument. And the case is submitted for consideration, and court is adjourned.
All rise.